This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Professor, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
Thank you. Professor Hill, please make whatever statement you would wish to make to the committee.
Her name is now synonymous with many things. Controversy, courage, even conspiracy. But in 1991, when she appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and accused then-Judge Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment, Anita Hill was simply a 35-year-old law professor at the University of Oklahoma.
His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes.
Hill's testimony broke the silence around workplace sexual harassment. It forever changed the tenor of Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And it also turned Hill into a complex political icon. The black woman facing a barrage of questions from a panel of white men. The woman who forced the nation to rethink its conception of equality. Here she is responding to Senator Howell Heflin, Democrat of Alabama.
Do you have a militant attitude relative to the area of civil rights?
No, I don't have a militant attitude.
Do you have a martyr complex?
No, I don't.
Well, the issue of fantasy has arisen.
There is no indication of that I'm an individual who is not in touch with reality on a regular basis that would be subject to fantasy.
Are you interested in writing a book?
No, I'm not interested in writing a book.
People say, well, how could you answer the senator's questions?
Anita Hill is now a professor at Brandeis University.
And I can only say that I knew that if I could live up to my mother's standards, that the senators would pale in comparison, that they would not be a challenge at all. And so I pitched my testimony to her high standards.
In fact, Hill's mother and her 12 older brothers and sisters sat right behind her during the Thomas hearings. She says their presence brought her a sense of stability. Home had come with her to Washington. And it is the subject of home, the ultimate symbol of economic success and equality, that is at the center of Anita Hill's new book. Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, is a personal and legal analysis of the American dream, beginning with the story of Hill's own family and ending with the social cost of the subprime crisis. We talked about it and the legacy of the Thomas hearings when I recently visited her at what she calls her academic home, her office at Brandeis' Heller School for Social Policy and Management in Waltham. Professor Hill, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. And please call me Anita.
Now, you helped do this analysis in terms of home and its import through telling the story of your own family, that within the span of one generation, members of your family went from being a property to being property owners in America. And I wonder if you could tell us about Molly Elliott.
Molly Elliott, let me just say that my family story for me was what really clarified in my mind the idea that home is not just that space, the place where we live, but it's also a state of being.
She's your great-grandmother.
My great-grandmother, enslaved in rural Arkansas and pregnant. And she was sold away from the man who she was living with as her husband. She was moved to a county called Little River County, Arkansas. And she remained there as a slave after she gave birth to my grandfather. Shortly after she gave birth to my grandfather, the war ended, and she was a free person. And for the first time in her life, she had to experience life as a free person and to understand what that meant, even as she was living in the place where she had been enslaved, in the same cabin where she had been enslaved. So the state of mind, her state of mind had to change. And I think as a way of showing that she was not the same Molly who had been enslaved. Actually, she became Molly Elliott after she became a free woman. She changed her name from where she had been as Mary, and changed her name to Molly, and began to raise her son, my grandfather, Henry Elliott,
May I stop you for just one moment? Because during and after the Civil War, so here we have a moment in history, in your family's history, where the same location takes on two very profoundly different significances.
Right. The place has not changed at all, but her condition has changed. And psychologically, she must change, and she must teach her son to live as a free person, something that she'd never experienced herself. And I believe the evidence of her having done that was ultimately in his life. He was then able to take advantage of the laws that allowed for homesteading and to accumulate 80 acres of land in the same area. So it was a transition of years, really about 4 or 5 decades, that they really began to exercise their freedom, and that to develop the psychology that would allow them to live as free people. And so that's the state of being at home, not only as a space, but to take that space and transform it into not something that reminded them of being enslaved, but something that signified their freedom.
Could they have done that without the Homesteading Act, without actually being vested owners of the land?
I think ownership, because it is such a part of what we think of as the American dream, that ownership took on symbolic significance. To be a part of the American dream is to own property. And so for them, yes, definitely in that generation, ownership was essential. But my cousin, who tells the story of their owning the property, also tells me that they lost it. There were some debt agreements that were completely one-sided. There was a downturn in the agricultural economy. And there was also a threat of racial violence. My grandfather was threatened to be lynched. And with all of those things together, ultimately, I think it was the racial violence that forced them really off the land and forced their movement to Oklahoma, which is where I grew up. My Uncle George says that his father said he wanted to move to Oklahoma to raise his children in a better place. But at the same time, it was a very sad occasion for my grandfather because, as my uncle tells it as well, it was the first time that he had seen his father cry when they boarded the train to go to Oklahoma. My grandparents never again owned property, but they were able to accumulate enough money to give my mother a gift when she got married so that she could began to build her own home, and she and my father did own a farm that I grew up on.
So in a sense, they were able to at least transmit a gift that helped rebuild the sense of home.
They were rebuilding the dream, I believe, in the next generation.
Did she, as you were growing up, ever emphasize to you that being a property owner was an important part of how you might measure success in your life?
Absolutely. And it wasn't something that she said, you have to have your own home. She first said, you have to have your own education. That was the beginning. And I didn't realize, I don't think, how important owning a home was for her, my ownership of a home was for her, until I bought my first home. And I did so in Oklahoma. And when she came to visit me in that home, she was just ecstatic. She saw that as a symbol of my having made it.
See, the reason why I ask is, And forgive me for bringing in my own family history into this, but...
Not at all. I mean, can I just interject?
Sure.
Because I want people, as they read my story, to bring in their own thinking about home as we place ourselves in the world and try to understand our own experience and movement toward equality.
Well, I couldn't help but to do that because my parents are immigrants. They came from India. They grew up in impoverished circumstances in India where property ownership was not even a possibility. But they had successful immigrant experience here in the United States. I clearly remember when my parents bought their first home. I was 7 years old when we moved in. And ever since then, you know, my father especially, for a long time, until the recent housing crisis, you know, he told me, he tried to say over and over again, you know, by the time you're in your mid-30s, try to own a home.
It's a place where we begin to build on our dreams. That home, whether we own it or rent it, when we feel safe and secure in that space. And so it is a very, I hesitate to use the word sacred, but for many of us, it is a space that allows us to grow and become the best of who we can be. That is ultimately what we want from a home.
I'm speaking with Professor Anita Hill at her office in Brandeis University. Her new book is Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding a Home. It seems that your book deals with how do equality, the home, and the American dream really come together. I wonder, do you think the American dream itself ever actually included the concept of equality? Was it essential to the American dream?
It depends on who you ask. I think if you ask, for example, some of the people I referred to in Reimagining Equality, if you ask Nanny Helen Burroughs or if you ask Abigail Adams, I think they absolutely would say that equality and the American dream were integral components. I mean, I think if you ask perhaps John Adams, Abigail Adams' husband, he would say no. So in envisioning the American dream, I can't imagine it any other way except to include equality.
So in your book, Reimagining Equality, in the introduction, there's a very challenging statement that you make. You say, I raise the question of whether the idea of home as a repository of the American dream and the signifier of equality can coexist with the concept of housing as a measure of national economic prosperity. Now, you would think that if we were living in a society where we had reached a certain level of equality, that national economic prosperity would be strongly correlated with that. But are you saying that they should no longer be correlated, that we should disconnect the two?
I'm saying that as long as we allow economic inequalities to exist, then we can't ever expect to close the gap because the cost of housing is increasing. But we're not keeping pace with that in terms of economic equity and equality for so many people. We know that gender and race are all still indicators of our economic wealth.
And so using housing as a measure masks those basic inequities.
It allows those inequities to continue. Historically, what we have said to people is that, and I use this, my model I use is the Jeffersons. When we knew the sitcom of the Jeffersons that came out in the 70s and 80s, we knew that George and Louise Jefferson had made it.
They were moving on up.
Because they were moving on up to the Upper East Side, and it was so idyllic that they described it as a deluxe apartment in the sky. And that was a measure of African Americans having made it in America. But it's something that is not achievable for most Americans. So if we can't continue to measure prosperity in a way that is unachievable for most of us. We have to start thinking about prosperity in a different way. That model that we held out there for people in the Jeffersons will not work in the 21st century.
I'm speaking with Professor Anita Hill at her office at Brandeis University. Her book is Reimagining Equality: Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. The last couple of questions I have for you, Professor Hill, it is the 20th anniversary of the time where you sat in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the now infamous Clarence Thomas hearings. I know you've been asked this before, but, you know, Herman Cain, he's no longer running for the GOP nomination for president because several women came forward and alleged that he had sexually harassed them. So on the one hand, the very fact that women felt courageous and supportive enough to do so, to come forward, I think says we've come a long way since 1991. But on the other hand, at least one of those women in particular chose to stay anonymous because her lawyer was quoted as saying she didn't want to end up being the next Anita Hill. When you heard that, what did that make you think about overall the progress that's been made regarding sexual harassment?
Well, it is a difficult thing to come forward, but I can say that a lot of women have come forward, and they've come forward publicly. But it is it's a difficult choice, and it's a personal choice. I can't say that I like being Anita Hill, and I wouldn't trade my place with anyone else. But there is another part of it, the story, the Herman Cain story. Americans confirmed that this behavior matters, that sexual harassment matters. It is a reflection on the character and the judgment of individuals who participate in it, who engage in harassing behavior. It is a reflection on their respect for the law, and it's a reflection on their ability to be leaders. And so I think that has been affirmed. I will say this, though. We are not going to be able to change the behavior in 20 years. This is behavior that has been going on since time immemorial. And so to think that we are going to be able to get rid of it in 20 years is not realistic. But I think we've moved monumentally in the 20 years since the hearings.
Now, regarding those hearings, you were 35?
Yes.
At the time? I'm 36 now, and it's hard, if not impossible, for me to imagine myself doing what you did at the age I am now, sitting before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and those senators who at that time were all white men, and making testimony and sharing a story that was going to change political history in America. So I guess my question for you is, at that moment, when you were at that table, how were you feeling? I mean, what was your heart rate like? What was going through your mind?
Well, I don't think at that moment that I had any real sense of what would happen in the future. And maybe I wouldn't even allow myself to think about that. My purpose in testifying was to really tell the truth about my experience. And that's what I had in mind doing. And that was a task that I had set for myself. My task wasn't to change, even to change the senator's mind, but it was to be able to tell my story and the truth that of what I had experienced in the workplace. And so, yes, I was anxious about that, but I didn't have the weight of the world in the sense that you describe on my shoulders at that point.
In fact, if I remember correctly, in a sense, you brought home with you into the hearing room because many members of your family came.
Well, I tell it in the sense that my mom was there, my father was there. But my mother really was the person who did most of the child rearing responsibilities and discipline and structure. And so if I left that room and she was pleased with me, I knew that I would have done what I had set out to do.
Professor Anita Hill, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I spoke with Anita Hill in her office at Brandeis University. Her new book is Reimagining Equality: Let us know what you think at radioboston.org.
And before we go today, here's a quick reminder. Radio Boston's Zip Code Story Project is looking for your stories about your neighborhoods. This month, we're focusing on Gloucester, Brockton, Wellesley, and Roslindale.
You don't have to live in one of these communities. Your story simply has to take place there. Submission guidelines are at radioboston.org. And remember, the deadline is Monday, January 9th.
Tomorrow on Radio Boston, with Iowa behind them, we'll catch up with the GOP presidential hopefuls in New Hampshire and assess the new shape of the race.
Also, a Harvard summer school instructor is dismissed after writing a controversial column in India, igniting a debate over free speech and academic freedom. That's all tomorrow on Radio Boston.
And Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.